What is the role of a journalist? Is the public getting an accurate portrayal of events around the nuclear standoff with North Korea? Should the West be congratulated for addressing the refugee crisis or criticized for instigating it? What happened to the anti-war movement? In what ways is criticism of the Trump administration misplaced? On this week's Global Research News Hour, with multiple crises confronting humanity, we delve into the unique challenges facing authentic journalism in 2017 with the legendary investigative reporter and award-winning documentary filmmaker, John Pilger, as interviewed by Winnipeg-based broadcast journalist and media critic, Leslie Hughes. On this week's program, An Honest Witness, John Pilger on truth-telling in the era of mainstream media fake news. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of October 6th, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. All domestic political factors aside, Cambodia is very strategically important nowadays because of its geographic location and relationship with China. President Hun Sen is one of Beijing's closest partners, both in the diplomatic sense, in terms of vetoing any hostile anti-Chinese motions by ASEAN, and also in the economic one, when it comes to Beijing's One Belt, One Road global vision of New Silk Road connectivity via forthcoming overland rail transit through Laos and current maritime accessibility through the Gulf of Thailand. From an American zero-sum perspective, Cambodia is seen as China's Trojan horse in Southeast Asia, and this is why President Hun Sen is being targeted for removal. That said, the U.S. is cautious about how much pressure it puts on him because it doesn't want to instigate a regional crisis, or at least not at this point. Cambodia is also slated to play a crucial role in the joint Indo-Japanese Asia-Africa Growth Corridor, also known as the Freedom Corridor, because it's a transit state along the southern and southern coastal corridors between Myanmar's Japanese-invested Special Economic Zone port of Dawei in the Bay of Bengal and southern Vietnamese ports along the South China Sea. That comes from the article, Cambodia is Trying to Snip a Color Revolution Attempt in the Bud, by Andrew Korobko, posted October 4th, originally appearing in Oriental Review as a partial transcript of the Context Countdown radio program on Sputnik News. Since communal violence in 2012, where mosques and Buddhist temples were attacked, leading to the murder of Buddhists and Muslims, Myanmar has been targeted with a growing foreign-backed Islamist insurgency in North Rakhine State, where Bengali Muslims are the ethno-religious majority. The Buddhist majority in Myanmar fear that if illegal Bengali immigration is not curbed, they may one day face the same persecution as their co-religionists in Bangladesh. Murders and rapes of Buddhists by Takfiri terrorists are regularly documented in Bangladesh, where the growing Wahhabi death cult is receiving copious funding from Saudi Arabia. Since the destruction of the ancient statues of Buddha in Afghanistan by the Taliban in 2001, there have been growing religious tensions in Southeast Asia. The strategic objective of Western imperialism in Asia is to exploit those tensions by stoking sectarian hatred, a Huntingtonian clash of civilizations, which provides the pretext for humanitarian intervention, quote-unquote, or anti-terrorist counterinsurgency operations by the United States and its allies. That comes from the article, Who is Responsible for Ethnic Cleansing in Myanmar? The Rohingya, Imperialism's New Cause, Part 1, by Gerard Okolman, posted October 1st, originally appearing at American Herald Tribune. Britain's Disasters and Emergency Committee has launched a major appeal for the Rohingya with the UK government, led by Theresa May, who coincidentally also studied at St. Hugh's College, Oxford, leading from the rear by pledging that the government would match the first £3 million donated by the public. If humanity existed, the government would surely have led, donating the first major tranche of money and urging the public to join. But then, when it is of a mindset that appoints a foreign secretary, the country's foremost quote-unquote diplomat, who said yesterday of Sirte in Libya, where Muammar Gaddafi was horrifically, barbarically slaughtered and which Secretary Boris Johnson had recently visited, quote, there's a group of UK business people, wonderful guys who want to invest in Sirte, and they literally have a brilliant vision to turn Sirte, to turn it into the next Dubai. The only thing they've got to do is clear the dead bodies away, and then they'll be there, unquote. That comes from the article, From Myanmar to Whitehall to Washington, Politics Festering Nadir, by Felicity Arbuthnot, posted October 5th. While the SCO, with headquarters in Beijing, is not officially a military alliance, it nonetheless serves as a geopolitical and strategic counterweight to US, NATO, and its allies. In the course of the last few years, the SCO has extended its cooperation in military affairs and intelligence. War games were held under the auspices of the SCO. With Pakistan and India as full members, the SCO now encompasses an extensive region which now comprises approximately half of the world's population. The simultaneous instatement of both countries as full members of the SCO is not only symbolic, it marks a historic shift in geopolitical alignments, which has a de facto bearing on the structure of economic and military agreements. That comes from the article, Middle East and Asia Geopolitics, Shift in Military Alliances, by Professor Michel Chalsadovsky, posted September 30th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Well, this week is Pass the Mic Week at host station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. And so I decided to pass the mic to my good friend and colleague, Leslie Hughes. She is, of course, a veteran print and broadcast journalist based here in Winnipeg. And also her commentaries appear regularly on the back page of Canadian Dimension magazine. So welcome, Leslie Hughes.
Hello, lucky me.
Now, Leslie, you had a chance to interview pretty much anyone that we could manage to connect you with, and you chose John Pilger. So I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about who he is and what makes his such a crucial voice at this time in history.
John Pilger. It was a great pleasure to talk to him. He is actually an Australian, as you will shortly hear from his accent, living in London, but quite the world traveler, as the news demands these days. He actually has been working since about the 1960s, roughly, and I think his body of work is approaching about 70 documentaries, features, pieces, and I first noticed him actually about the time of the East Timor events, which was one of the areas of the world that interested him, and not just as a journalist, of course, but as an Australian, presented particular issues to that country. So it not just the output, really, but the attitude is what attracted me. In that he appears not to be afraid of saying anything as long as he knows it's true, right? Which is, I don't think there's an awful lot of that going around now. I think what goes around is more like, oh, what did you want me to say? You know, the difference between being an employee and being independent, I think, is what's allowed this to happen. Just to go on briefly, perhaps our listeners would appreciate that he is in the tradition of I.F. Stone. I.F. Stone, you know, being the origin of that great reminder, government's lie.
Yeah.
Which really we should hear, I think, as authorities lie, right? For their own good reasons.
Yeah, but it's refreshing to hear that.
Oh, to remember that with compassion, to know that the people that you're covering or the people you're interviewing may be hiding the truth and you don't know why they're hiding the truth. In some cases, people are not even aware that they're hiding the truth. So I would ask our listeners to really listen carefully here to a man who I think is an essential model for journalists, in that he is a reminder of that I.F. Stone tradition and of the importance of context and balanced sources and being invested in only one thing, and that is the truth, clarity, which is what allows people to take action.
Okay. So is there anything else you wanted to say before we just begin the interview?
Oh, blah, blah, blah. I could go on about John Pilger all day, but it's just so refreshing, you know, to be in his company. And thank you for making this possible for, you know, to share the time and the experience of John Pilger and for the chance to share that with our listeners. Who knows who could be changed by this?
Well, talking about sharing with our listeners, I think it's about time they had a listen to what Mr. Pilger has to say.
Oh, yeah. I think I just got the boot. Okay.
So here is John Pilger as interviewed by Leslie Hughes on the Global Research News Hour.
Joining us from London, England, is the Emmy and Academy Award-winning documentary filmmaker and legendary investigative reporter, John Pilger. Hello, John.
Hello, Leslie. Good to be talking to you.
Now, just to frame our conversation, would you tell me exactly what you consider to be the job of a journalist?
Well, the job of a journalist is to keep the record straight. It's very simple. In fact, investigative was only added to journalists around the time of, I think, Watergate, when everyone thought they were going to be investigative journalists. Journalism is about investigating. It is about pursuing the truth as comprehensively as possible. But it's also about not accepting at face value the messages of so much so-called news. In other words, it is being alert all the time to propaganda, especially propaganda from on high, from authority. Journalists ought to be agents of people, not agents of power.
So, as you say, the journalist has an obligation to pursue the truth independently and record that. Are journalists anywhere today actually free to do that job?
Well, in some, yes, there are some very, very good journalists, and including those who are even inside the so-called corporate media, who are almost subversives. Very few, because dissent has been almost outlawed. Propaganda is now so all-pervasive that journalists doing their job, and that is basically, again, to define it again, I suppose it's dissenting from the received wisdom, from what authority has to say. That's very difficult these days. But thanks to the World Wide Web, there are journalists who are investigating, pursuing the truth, writing about it, filming it, broadcasting it. We have to look closely, look carefully to find them sometimes, but we know where they are.
Nuclear tensions, just for an example, John, nuclear tensions, in fact, what some people would say nuclear chicken, ostensibly between the U.S. and North Korea, are leading the news again today. Are we getting an accurate story?
No. No. The impression is that it's all one way, that that the U.S., even the U.S. under the Mr. Trump, is really up against some maniacal, almost absurdist figure. Now, there are certainly aspects about the North Koreans that reflect their history, and that is a history of the most awful violence and siege. There is a siege mentality about them. But above all, there is a sense of preventing, interestingly, preventing them being blown to bits. Because the unfortunate truth is that had the North Koreans not developed these nuclear weapons and this rocketry to go with it, they would have probably, almost certainly, been blown to bits by now, because that's what happened to them during the so-called Korean War. The country was leveled. And that history of not all that long ago, it's within a lifetime. That is like a presence in North Korea, and it feeds into the siege mentality, which produces the kind of apparently provocative provocations that we're seeing currently. But what the North Koreans have always wanted, and what they are saying now, the subtext to the histrionics coming from their side is, we want a peace treaty with the United States. They've always wanted it. They don't want to be attacked by the United States. They've lived in fear of being attacked since the early 1950s when they were attacked. During the 1990s, there was the beginnings of an agreement with the Clinton administration. It was called the Framework Agreement, in which the North Koreans would give up their nuclear weaponry aspirations for guarantees and ultimately for a peace treaty. That agreement, that very fragile early agreement, was torn up the moment George W. Bush came to office. And that's what this is about. The threat to North Korea has been daily coming from the United States, mainly with its South Korean military vassal force. That's what it is. Of course, the frightening thing about the present situation is that it could start by miscalculation, by mistake, or by accident. That's how, in my opinion, nuclear war could start.
Well, now, you write frequently about what you call the invisible government behind the scenes everywhere, which has neither allegiance nor responsibility to populations. Who are these people, and what is their relationship to media? Because I think they have a big impact on world events.
Well, the media really is the invisible government these days. That's the term used by Edward Bernays early 1920s, when he said that the real power, and I paraphrase him, the real power of the land, excuse me, is that of an invisible government. He was referring to the industry which he really helped to start, and that's public relations, spin. And during the First World War, he played a major role with others of helping to convince the American political establishment and to many Americans that they should be fighting in the Great Slaughter in Europe. And he invented with his colleagues the whole idea of images mattering, the facts not mattering, of illusions mattering, the facts not mattering. And we have almost a distilled version of that today, when the propaganda is so pervasive, it's everywhere. It's so repetitive. And you mentioned North Korea, even rather sketchy explanation I tried to give of the history of North Korea and the United States is barely known, if at all. And it should be written into every news story to do with North Korea. In that way, people would have a sense of the problem and a sense of the real danger.
I was saying the media directs the population, and who is directing the media?
Well, I don't think you should put it as if it is a group of faceless people sitting in a room, a number of big brothers. I think the system is so sophisticated now, it really works on its own. The media, part of the power of the invisible government is its deployment of myths that really we live in a superior and benign society. That's the current that runs through most news, that we know best. But really, the media see, as our governments see, the world in terms of its usefulness. That's an imperialist view. The actual empires of Europe really existed until quite a short time ago, and the new empire, that is of the United States, is a version of that. And that its view of the world runs through all news. There are some exceptions, as I mentioned in the beginning. There are journalists who are honorable exceptions. But broadly speaking, we get the propaganda of an imperium, of those who see the world as their right to control.
Now, to look at just a couple briefly of contemporary examples, can we consider the Western media's treatment of what you've described as the human stampede to Europe? Although we're certainly feeling it here, even in Canada, in North America. Do you think that we are understanding the origins of that event, or we're prepared to deal with it rationally?
Well, it's very much like the issue of North Korea. If you take out a contextualizing truth that does explain or begin to explain why these extraordinary events are happening, then you then call people, you call upon people then to reflect on what is really happening. The stampede of people from Africa, North Africa especially, certainly from the Middle East, is the product of Western actions. The stampede of people from Syria is the product of an all-out assault on that country. We now see, those who don't understand that really haven't been concentrating, because the assault now has been well underway since 2011, the use of certain proxy armies to overthrow the government in Syria. That has produced an horrific, at the most, civil war in that country, but it's really an invasion of that country. That has produced a huge number of refugees from Syria.
In the media here, we see the refugee is the enemy, is the threat. How fair is that?
Well, of course, it's unfair. A refugee is a refugee. A refugee is a person fleeing for their lives, fleeing for their lives of their families. A refugee is someone seeking refuge. And those who deny this refuge to fellow human beings are denying their own humanity. I mean, if we don't help people who are fleeing for their lives, what are we here for? But apart from that rather obvious moral statement, I have to say there are very hard political forces at work here. The refugees that have drowned in the Mediterranean, you know, this terrible mass death of people, innocent people, women, men, and children trying to cross the Mediterranean to safety, is largely caused by the assault on Libya, the overthrow of the government and destruction of a modern state in Libya, Africa's greatest oil producer, destroying the infrastructure, reducing this country to a place of warring factions and tribal hatreds and warring militias. All that was, the tribal hatreds may have been there to begin with, but the extraordinary thing about the Gaddafi regime, and regardless of what one thought of the way it behaved at times, it did unite, or at least suppress, a lot of those warring factions. But in attacking Libya, the United States, France, Britain, other NATO countries, and NATO itself in 2011 really destroyed the gates to Africa. And through those gates have come many people, most of them refugees, many of the from sub-Saharan Africa, from conflict and mayhem that followed on the attack on Libya in 2011. So the short answer really is that Europe and the United States have caused this flight of refugees, of the likes of which we haven't seen before. It's an extraordinary tragedy, but the first tragedy is that so many people seem not to understand why it happened.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
Now, looking at for just a moment at Donald Trump, whom you have described as a media hate figure, you've said that he's not the problem, that we ourselves are the problem. What do you mean by that?
Well, he's part of the problem, clearly. I mean, Trump is almost the embodiment of the problem. He is a symptom of it, at the very least. He is a caricature of his predecessors. But he's not the singular cause of the problems of great power that are being imposed on other countries. When I say we are the problem, the we refers to those of us who do not, who have been depoliticized, if you like, who have been lobotomized into believing the propaganda that the liberal powers in Western capitals, in Washington, in London, and in Brussels and elsewhere, are really offer some kind of social justice and hope for the world. The support of liberal forces within the United States, especially for the rapacious Hillary Clinton, with a record, a warmongering record, second to none, almost allowed Trump to happen. They almost allowed Hillary Clinton to happen. In fact, she did win the popular vote in the United States. My point is, when I say we, I ask a question: where is the real opposition? People going out and protesting on Trump's inauguration day are not very impressive. They didn't protest Obama, probably the most violent president of the United States for a very long time, whose legacy is seven wars, the beginning of a provocation of China, the actual provocation of Russia with NATO forces now lined up along the western borders of Russia. It was Obama who left us with the dangerous world that Trump is now, is he making it more dangerous? It looks like it. But that's where it came from. And Obama came from George W. Bush. In other words, the system has produced these. Where is the opposition? Where is the great opposition to the threat of nuclear war? Where is anything to compare with, say, the Great Freeze movement that saw a million people fill the streets of Manhattan in 1980 and European cities? Because we're probably closer to nuclear and a nuclear mistake or an accident now than we've ever been. But where is the opposition to this? The opposition seems to be so easily distracted. Even Charlottesville seemed to be a massive distraction, because the racism that Charlottesville demonstrated is right across the United States, right across imperial countries. It was exported from this country, actually. So until a system is faced, as I think great opposition movements in the past, and I mentioned one, the anti-nuclear movement in the 1980s, when the United States was in the process of deploying nuclear weapons, so-called usable nuclear weapons, to Europe. Where is the opposition that in the 1960s and the 1970s reflected a kind of internationalism that seemed to understand that the world was threatened by a system? The idea of concentrating it on the personality of one man, and my goodness, the personality of this man is quite something, but the idea of being utterly distracted by that. And, you know, I've read, and I won't name them, people of some reputation, liberal writers, who are now looking back forlornly on the great days of Obama. This suggests to me that the depoliticizing, and I mean politicizing in the sense of understanding how great imperial power works, the depoliticizing has been largely successful. Obama's greatest achievement was his destruction, effective destruction of the anti-war movement. Where are the people in the streets? And I don't mean the Occupy movement, and I don't mean those people who came out on Trump's inauguration day.
I just wonder if it's possible that people, the protesters, if you want, went home, got back on the couch because of the failure to influence at the time of the invasion of Iraq. Do you recall those huge, massive, international, interfaith protests that went nowhere? Could that have been a turning point? And if it is, how do we get people to reclaim any sense of political power?
Well, I do. I spoke at one of those, and I wasn't in London at the time, but I think the biggest demonstration of all time was here, and I've heard that from many people. No, it didn't. It didn't work in Iraq, but it didn't work because many people attending these demonstrations thought that you could go out for the day and have a pleasant demonstration and go home and the war would stop. It doesn't work like that. And that's what we've lost. We've lost the sense of sustaining an opposition, of being, so many people have been seduced by these false liberal gods. Even Hillary Clinton, when you have somebody like Gloria Steinem, this extraordinary icon of her great era, supporting a terribly corrupt warmonger like Hillary Clinton, then we have a problem. When you have people fawning in the most obsequious way over Barack Obama in a kind of reverse racism, the first African president, African American president in the land of slavery. But once you've said those words, that's the end of his distinction, because he was a man of the system. What he did do was he did organize the first modern American invasion of Africa. That's hardly had any attention. The setting up of AFRICOM in Addis Ababa, in Addis Ababa, and the militarization of one African country after the other by the United States. The spread of US special forces right throughout Africa and right across the world in something like, I believe, 132 countries. That has not been addressed, whereas the spirit of those great demonstrations was all very well, but it was largely superficial because it didn't go on. And it's only movements that go on and go through good times and bad times, but keep going on, that have any possibility of succeeding.
Just a note here, if you have the new structural theme that the news is fake, which as we know it often is, if you have privately owned corporate media news chains and broadcast networks that appear to be lying and dying, and the world of social media is not actually accountable yet, much of it, how can citizens acquire trustworthy information without which they can't do what it is you want them to do?
But even the way you ask the question, it's sort of like, give us the word. If citizens don't know how to do it in privileged countries like Canada, the United States, the United Kingdom, Australia, where have they been? You know, they have access to extraordinary tools of finding out, of extending freedom. The web is one of them. I don't believe social media is the problem. Social media is it's almost a separate problem in that it's produced a rather introspection among people. It's directed people's gaze to their navel and not out to other people. Fake news is a notion. Edward Bernays would have been absolutely proud of the whole fake news campaign. It was invented by the so-called corporate media to accuse social media of being fake, when in fact the real fake news is what you turn on every night if you bother to turn on the television from your CBC News to your NBC News to your BBC News. So much in that is fake news. I find, having been a journalist for some considerable time, I find a lot of that, those broadcasts, and they're very influential, they're very powerful, unwatchable, because I have to sit there and either deconstruct them or monitor them. They're not possible to watch. There's no information. They're so loaded. That's fake news. And it's not just Fox News. That's the whipping boy, and Fox News, like Donald Trump's, pretty bad. Pretty bad. But it's the New York Times and the Guardian and the Washington Post. This whole warmongering Russiagate story, which has no foundation whatsoever. That story has been promoted most vigorously by the so-called respectable media, by the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Guardian, the BBC, and the other networks, and so on. And here's this sort of grotesque irony, because the one thing that we might have salvaged, if you like, if that's the word, from the Trump era, is him doing a deal with Vladimir Putin not to blow the world up. Sitting down, he seems to, and I'm not quite sure myself, I've asked why he's doing this. I've I've followed the excellent work of Professor Stephen Cohen of NYU and Princeton, who is very good at explaining it, but I'm still not absolutely sure. But the point is that Trump, the one consistency in Trump, the one bit of sanity, glimpse of sanity, has been Trump wanting to do a deal with the Russians to perhaps reinstate what is about to be thrown out, such as the intermediate nuclear weapons treaty. That Congress is about to get rid of that. That marked the end of the Cold War when it was agreed between Reagan and Gorbachev. That's about to go. Trump has clearly wanted to do some kind of deal with the Russians. He's been stopped. He's been stopped by a Congress that has just voted overwhelmingly, with only a few dissenters, to wage economic war on Russia. So, and the Russians, of course, have come back and said, well, you know, what's the point of all this? So what they've succeeded, what those who have focused their minds on the great nemesis of Trump have succeeded, they've succeeded in allying themselves with forces within the whole US power structure that sees Russia as important to keep a Cold War and a war machine and a national security apparatus going. And that is our great loss at the moment. North Korea has certainly taken us to a very frightening edge, but deeper down, our great loss is this denial of an opportunity to have a proper diplomatic relationship with Russia of the kind that some of the most conservative Americans negotiated, the likes of the great treaty negotiators who negotiated the START treaties and the nuclear treaties, such as the one, the most very important one I mentioned, the Intermediate Weapons Treaty, which means that you can't fire these short-range nuclear weapons at another country. They're about to be thrown out. Do people know this? I don't know.
The thing is, I do hear a very, I hope I'm not imagining this, I think I hear a sense of hope in what you are saying, a sense of the possibility that individuals can recover their political power. And you are so close to the situation. You have seen things in great detail. So you think this in spite of the apparently infinite resources of the militarists and the propagandists? Do I really sense a sense of hope from you?
Woody Allen said something about hope. I'm not a great fan of Woody Allen, but he said something about hope. And as you were speaking, I was trying to remember what it was, but it was basically...
A steal. He stole it from Emily Dickinson. It's that thing with feathers.
Hey, what did you say? Tell me.
Hope is that thing with feathers. I remember Dickinson, but not Woody Allen.
So, okay. Well, anyway, I don't rely on hope. That's my message. If we get down to hope, then we've got our thumb in our mouth. Of course, hope doesn't win. Hope doesn't change things. Of course, you have to be motivated, and of course, you have to struggle and keep going. But if it all comes down to hope, you are in danger then into falling into a Barack Obama advertising campaign. You remember he called himself Mr. Hope, and there were all those posters of hope. He gave hope a bad name.
Yes, we can, he said. but he didn't.
No, well, all I'm saying is, without making too much of it, I'm very suspicious of hope. I think we should be doing things. I think we should be informing ourselves. I think we should wake up from this great postmodern coma that we've been in since the book The Greening of America was published, and the so-called meism was invented, and along with it, various versions of it, now called identity politics and so on. And the whole idea that there are different classes of people, there are people with different needs under moral laws of social justice were thrown out. Those ideas were thrown out. We should go and find out where we threw them and get them back again, because that's what made the great movements. Following a Bernie Sanders or a Jeremy Corbyn isn't a great movement. It's following a party, and a very familiar one at that. It isn't a great movement. And things are so urgent these days, we need a great movement.
Do you see one coming?
I don't know. I don't know at the moment. I think there are all the ingredients for a great movement. The paradox is that we've probably never been more aware, but we've never been more distracted as well. It's interesting. They clash, those two things. We're very aware, but we're distracted. Some years ago, we weren't as aware, but we weren't distracted. And it's those distractions, some of them willful, some of them very willful, we have to understand some truths. And one truth is that we live in a propaganda world. It used to be called the information age. It was never an information age, it was a media age. And we have to understand that the media is extension of great power. And that great power is doing some extraordinarily destructive things in the world. So the old truism that information is power needs respect again. Until we have the information, and until we are not distracted, we really can't do much about what is happening in the world.
I'm wondering if this calls for a revolution in journalism education.
Well, I think yes. I think I don't have much time for journalism colleges, because I think all they do is teach journalists, many of them. There are some exceptions. I say very quickly, but many of them are simply giving journalists, young journalists, who arrive with enthusiasm, although I read the other day so many more now going into public relations, the drop in young people wanting to be journalists has been quite dramatic in recent years, both in this country and especially in the United States. So as journalism and public relations have been merged into, info commercials, sponsored journalism, journalism has lost its what it always ought to have been, and what it should be today, and that's something of a vocation. I'm afraid that's a very old-fashioned word, but I think it's quite a good word. When journalism became the product of corporations, and when journalism schools began feeding these great corporations, it lost that sense of vocation that produced, at best, some extraordinary mavericks of journalists who brought great truths and to large numbers of people. We haven't seen that for quite a while. That's why whistleblowers are so important today. That's why the likes of Edward Snowden and Julian Assange, and of course Chelsea Manning and others, are so important today. And that's why they generated so much anger, why WikiLeaks has generated and Assange has generated so much anger from within the mainstream media, because they shame mainstream journalism. Whistleblowers and organizations like WikiLeaks shame them because they're doing their job. They're doing the job of journalists.
Leaving the word hope carefully behind, what energizes you to continue your work?
I don't know how to answer that. I'm energized, I suppose, by a sense of how privileged I am to be a journalist. You know, I became a journalist at the age of 17, and I couldn't believe how lucky I was. I was given access into people's homes. I could write their stories. I could see how people in other countries lived, how they struggled against often impossible odds. My first book was called Heroes, and that was to celebrate those people I met as a journalist. So I still have that rather, I suppose, almost boyish belief in journalism. It's a very old-fashioned view, perhaps, but that certainly energizes me. There are a few other things that energize me as well, but we won't go into them. People energize me.
It's wonderful to talk to you.
It's very nice talking to you too, Leslie.
Sure.
I hope that there you are. I've just used the word "I hope," and I hope that we get some hope from this.
I hope so too.
Good. We're so full of hope. We shall get the Obama Prize for hope.
Thank you, John. Thank you, John Pilger.
You're very welcome. Bye.
That interview with John Pilger was recorded September 4th, 2017. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.